Hello, readers. I hope you're having a terrific day. My name is Jason Jeffries, and I'm your host for Bookin', presented by Quail Ridge Books, Raleigh, North Carolina's trusted independent source for books and book-related news. Today, my guest is the legendary Nebula Award-winning author John Kessel, author of Corrupting Dr. Nice, Good News from Outer Space, Another Orphan, The Moon in the Other, and most recently, Pride and Prometheus, published by Saga Press, a division of Simon & Schuster. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm so excited that you can join us today. Now, John, and excuse my language, listeners, but you wrote the hell out of this book, didn't you? I didn't know what I was expecting or what to expect when I picked it up, but I was not expecting a masterwork of literary sci-fi and horror, which it most definitely is. The novel Pride and Prometheus, for those of you who don't know, is an extension of a shorter story of the same name, and that story won the Nebula Award in 2008. The novel, as some of you may have guessed, is a mashup of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, but it's so much more than that. What gave you the idea to bring these two disparate works together?
Well, I was at a writer's retreat and workshop, and we were discussing each other's manuscripts, and one of the other writers there, a fellow named Ben Rosenbaum, had a story that was a takedown of Jane Austen, and it was pretty funny. But as we were talking about it, it occurred to me that Jane Austen was writing contemporary to Mary Shelley, even though they didn't know each other, and Shelley was a generation younger. And yet I've teach English and American literature, but I'd never had seen the two writers talked about together, and certainly not the books. And so that got me thinking about the differences between Jane Austen and Mary Shelley, between the novel of manners, which is Jane Austen's, or she's the mother of that, and the Gothic and science fiction, which Mary is one of the progenitors of. And so that really got me thinking about it. And then I was reading Pride and Prejudice, and I noticed that it says that Mr. Darcy's estate is Pemberley is near the town of Matlock in Derbyshire. And it happens that Victor Frankenstein and his friend Henry, when they come to England later in Frankenstein, pass through the town of Matlock. So I thought, wow, that's a coincidence that I've never seen anyone do anything with. So I immediately started thinking, how could I bring these two things together?
And in the introduction of the book, you thank Karen Joy Fowler for asking you to write it. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. Karen saw the original story, Pride and Prometheus, which was a novelette. And she told me, you know, John, this should be a novel. And at that point, I didn't really feel like it was a novel. I thought I had told everything I needed to tell. And not only that, at the same time, about that time, the novel Pride and Prejudice and Zombies came out, which I did not like. It's not really a novel. It's kind of a joke. And I wanted to write something serious. And so I sort of didn't want to be put in the same box as that. So I put it aside. But then 8 years later, I was thinking about it, and I realized I had not really told. I'd told sort of the middle of the story, but not the beginning or the end. And so what was originally the novelette is the events of that story are still in this book. But I would really kind of defy anyone to find any beginning or ending there. I really did transform it into a much longer story.
Great, thanks. And the narrative structure of this book is such that the chapters alternate in perspective from a third-person narrative of Mary Bennett and an internal first-person narrative of both Dr. Victor Frankenstein and sometimes of his creation, the monster who eventually assumes the moniker Adam. Can you tell us a bit about why you chose this structure for Pride and Prometheus?
Yeah, one reason was that the styles of Jane Austen and Mary Shelley are so different. And one of the differences is that Jane Austen's novels are all told in third person, where the author speaks, but enters the consciousness of her main characters. And so I decided I would write my main heroine of the story is Mary Bennett, the middle of the Bennett sisters from Pride and Prejudice. So I decided I would write the Pride and Prejudice chapters, the Jane Austen chapters in third person like Jane Austen. And then Frankenstein's written in first person from the point of view of Victor and then the monster. And so I thought I would do those in first person. So the styles of the chapters match up with the characters who are the main characters in those chapters.
Great. And Frankenstein's Monster learns how to speak English from the Bible, which is, of course, a work of translation itself. Can you speak a little about the significance of this monster and entity? Even his creator, Dr. Frankenstein, refers to as a demon. Learning the English language by reading the Bible?
Right. Well, if you've read Frankenstein, which is a really interesting book, one of the things that's kind of curious about it is it's been adopted and translated into films and plays and TV shows for 200 years now, but very seldom has it been followed. I mean, one of the things, a fact about the book that I think my students are always surprised at, is that the monster in the book is so intelligent and so articulate. He learns English from reading the Bible and reading Paradise Lost. And so he's incredibly intelligent. He's brilliant. Not only that, he's agile, and he doesn't shamble around like the monster in the Boris Karloff version. And so I wanted to present this sort of Superman version of the creature. And the fact that he learned English from the Bible and from Paradise Lost means he's very engaged with the issues of sort of what does God owe to his creation, or what does a creator owe to his creation, and what does the creation owe to the creator? And Mary Shelley was quite consciously looking into that. So she was a political radical, and one of the subversive elements of it is that Victor is in the position of God here, but he's not a very good father. If you think about parenting, he's not a good parent. He abandons his child the minute it's created. And just the way that Adam eventually transgresses and is abandoned by God. And so there's a lot of theological stuff going on in Frankenstein. And for me, it's not so much theological as it is sort of what our responsibilities are towards one another, especially our children. And I think of the monster as Victor's child, who is rejected and abandoned by Victor, but also every human being that he encounters.
Mary Bennett in this novel is 32 years old. She has a developed scientific mind, and she has become a fossil hunter, an undertaking that is frowned upon by the polite society that her family is accustomed to. The quote from Mary herself, though she makes it in jest at the time, is, "Too much learning makes a woman monstrous." Can you frame the character of Mary Bennett for us as she lives in this novel, Pride and Prometheus?
Right. Well, if you remember, if you've read Pride and Prejudice, you know Mary is the middle sister of the five Bennett sisters. And she's not very spoken of in Pride and Prejudice. She's the bookish one. She plays the piano, probably not as well as she thinks she plays it. And she's also very moralistic. She reads sermons and is always preaching to her sisters about what they should and shouldn't do. She's kind of self-important and really not a very... She's mostly the butt of the joke in Pride and Prejudice. Well, I'm imagining her 13 years later. In Pride and Prejudice, she's about 19, and now she's 32. And she's learned a few things since then. For one thing, she's never had anyone really seek to court her or marry her. She's also the only plain sister of the Bennett sisters. And she realizes that her family doesn't really regard her that highly. And here she is aging, probably on the verge of spinsterhood. She's feeling that it's going to fall to her or to her sister, younger sister Kitty, who's also not married, to take care of their aging parents. I really wanted to make her a much more sympathetic character than she is in Pride and Prejudice. The other thing I thought about was, since she's so bookish, maybe she might get interested in science, although she expresses no interest in science in Pride and Prejudice. And so I have her become a fossil enthusiast, which was a thing at that time in the early 1800s. Fossils were being found in England and elsewhere, and people were wondering what the source of them was. And there was all kinds of natural philosophy discussions about fossils. And so this is her hobby, is collecting fossils, and that's how she meets a rich man who may be interested in her. His name is Mr. Woodley. But also, when she's at a ball, she meets Victor Frankenstein, who is surprised that she knows so much about science and treats her with a respect that she's never really gotten for her intellect before.
And to touch back on the issue of parenting, which you just alluded to, between Dr. Frankenstein and his creation. The other Bennets in this story are Mary's parents, who treat their 32-year-old daughter Mary as if she is still a child of 19, a treatment not dissimilar from that which Mary later reflects onto her sister Kitty when Kitty needs to, let's just say, go back to square one and relearn how to exist in this world. What is it about Mary's character that causes her to pass on this learned behavior, even though she hated to be on the receiving end of it from her parents?
You know, I think that's actually a fairly common thing of children, is that you chafe under the behavior of your parents. You see everything that they do that you think is wrong when you're an adolescent. And then when you get older, and if you have children yourself, you find yourself uncomfortably falling into the same habits unless you work hard not to. Or maybe you find, you know, the things that you objected to when you were a teenager seem more sensible when you're 35 years old. So Mary here, in a way, she's put in a position of responsibility and autonomy. Well, one of the things I like about my Mary is Mary has a real... She's not very worldly. She doesn't understand how the world works, but she's got a kind of stubbornness and persistence and also a care for doing the right thing that that stands her in good stead in this story. It seems to me she becomes really the hero of the book by the end of the book when no one's looking to be to a female spinster who's never really been anywhere to have any sense. But it turns out she has a lot of very good sense.
Thank you, John. Now we are going to take a break for a word from our sponsors. The Bookin' Podcast is sponsored by Libro FM Audiobooks. Libro FM lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore, Quail Ridge Books. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With Libro.fm, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know the name. But you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community. Listeners of Bookin' can get a 3-month audiobook membership for the price of one. Go to Libro FM, that's Libro.fm, and enter Bookin', Bookin, in the promo code space. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores. I am speaking with John Kessel, Nebula Award-winning author of Pride and Prometheus, published by Saga Press, a division of Simon & Schuster. John, I want to step away from speaking about Pride and Prometheus for a moment and talk about the current state of contemporary science fiction. There are a lot of quote-unquote mainstream literary authors who have plunged into the genre, going back a dozen years off the top of my head, and just to mention award winners, I can think of The Road by Cormac McCarthy, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde by Junot Diaz, Fortune Smiles by Adam Johnson, many of the shorter novellas of Roberto Bolaño, a Nobel Prize for Doris Lessing. I could go on and on. And yet,
Never
so many.
Let Me Go by.
yeah, Kazuo Ishiguro.
Right.
So many of these mainstream authors try to sidestep the labeling of their work as science fiction, though it very clearly is. Do you, John Kessel, have any feelings towards this topic?
I do. I vary in my feelings about it. For one thing, I think it's really wonderful that these writers are choosing to use speculative elements in their fiction and to treat them seriously and write at a high degree of sophistication and characterization and a prose style. I think that's all to the good. On the other hand, I do get a little annoyed because so many of them do say, oh, well, you know, this isn't really a science fiction book, you know, even though it's the kind of thing that people in the world of science fiction have been writing and publishing for 30 or 40 years. And I know exactly why they do this. It's because the label science fiction is in the publishing world and in the general readership, I think, is associated with, you know, blockbuster movies with large explosions, aliens, and superheroes, and things that aren't really considered to be very much for mature literary adults. And so they're afraid, I think, that their work won't be considered taken seriously if it's labeled science fiction. So it's a matter of real self-preservation, and it's generated by the publishing industry and its understanding of what they can sell and how they're going to sell it. But that leaves a lot of science fiction writers, at least like me, the ones who are striving for a kind of adult science fiction with sophistication and complexity, left out. Because, you know, we have our readers in the science fiction world, and they're very intelligent and understand what we're trying to do and will accept it. But we can't seem to get over that wall to find the readers outside of science fiction who basically say, well, I don't like science fiction, even though they like Never Let Me Go or The Road or Station 11 or books like that. So that's very frustrating for someone like me who's been writing science fiction for more than 40 years and publishing it, a lot of it, but has not consistently been able to reach readers who don't think they like science fiction, even though they read books that I think fall under that definition. Saga Books is a division of Simon & Schuster, are really one of the major publishers, and one of the things about Saga is that they publish a range of books and a lot of very serious literary science fiction. So that, I think, is to the good. I think they're developing a reputation. The imprint is only a few years old. And I hope people will take the chance to check out some of these books in the bookstore.
Yeah, and books are not films, and films are not books, and science fiction is a wonderful genre, and everyone should read more of it. Back to Pride and Prometheus. John, would you like to read us a passage from your book?
Okay, yes. I'm going to read a bit from fairly well along in the book. As you mentioned, the creature, the monster, comes to adopt the name of Adam. And what happens later in the book, Victor has agreed to create a mate for the monster. The monster's threatened to kill everyone that Victor loves if Victor refuses to do that. So Victor has traveled up to the Orkney Islands in northern Scotland to set up in a hut and put together a female mate. Meanwhile, Adam is traveling up there across the desolate northern Scotland, and it happens that he falls in with Mary, who is also trying to reach Victor, and they travel together. Mary at first is terrified of the monster, whom Victor has told her has murdered his little brother, among other things, and yet they are sort of forced in each other's company. And so here they are one evening. They're holed up in a deserted, broken-down barn, and they're in conversation around the fire Mary talks about being a spinster, and the creature is unfamiliar with human society, wonders what a spinster is. Mary says, "A spinster is an old unmarried woman. People think spinsters are funny and sad. If one has an income, one may live as one chooses, but a spinster is not doing the things that make a woman's life worthwhile, marrying, having children, taking care of her husband. It is a hollow existence, tedious in the extreme. The one use of a spinster is to take care of her parents as they age, but she's seldom given much credit for doing this by her siblings, who are wrapped up in their own marriages and children." Adam set another fragment of the broken stall into the fire. "I know what I lack that has set me on the road to this place. What did you lack that brought you here?" Mary thought over this question for some time before replying. "I lacked respect and attention. I was alone in the midst of my family. I am not beautiful, and the only man who has ever shown any interest in me as a possible wife is someone who behaves in ways that I find hard to tolerate."
"Did Victor show such interest?"
"He treated me as a person of intellect. Reflected in his eyes, I saw myself perhaps better than I am. I thought that he might care for me if it were not for the obligation he has to you. I thought if I saw him again, I might discover who he is. I wanted to protect him. I wanted to retrieve Kitty. I wanted many things." She sighed. "That was before I learned that he was engaged." The fire crackled. A slender ribbon of smoke rose through the open roof to the sky.
"If he fails me," Adam said, "you will not be able to protect him from my vengeance."
"I think," Mary said, "that as you continue in your career on Earth, you might consider finding some other means of persuasion than threats of death."
His eyes flashed with anger, and then his thin, dark lips split in a smile. She could not help but smile in return. I should hope not to have to resort to violence, he said. Assuming that we ever find him, I would feel better about our next meeting with Victor if you should vow not to harm him. Despite all the suffering that you lay at Victor's feet, I urge you to find in yourself some sympathy for him.
I have sympathy for you, he said. I think someone should have protected you from him.
Mary had nothing to say to this. If Victor had hurt her, it was as much a matter of her pursuing the opportunity for him to do so as it was by any intention of his. I suppose, she said, that if I should survive this adventure, I shall spend the rest of my days reading books of sermons, collecting fossils, practicing the pianoforte, and studying thorough bass.
Adam lifted his head. Thorough bass?
Music is one of the few studies considered appropriate for girls.
I know what a pianoforte is, but what is thorough bass?
Mary welcomed the chance to speak of something other than her foolishness. It is a theory of music. In thorough bass, one marks the intervals between notes. It is quite mathematical. Knowing which notes correspond with the notes of the melody allows one to sing harmony.
What is harmony?
Harmony is the science of musical chords. One sings, for instance, a single note. Let's say the note is this, a C. Mary sang a C as clearly as she could. As a girl, she had always been praised for having perfect pitch. Years later, Kitty confessed that everyone in the family had told Mary that simply to make her feel better about being plain. But she thought that this was a fair C, good enough for a monster at least. Now, can you make that sound? Just breathe in deeply, open your mouth wide, and let the sound come from your throat. Here, I'll sing you, and you match my tone. Adam looked skeptically at her. Mary sang another C. Adam opened his mouth and emitted a hoarse cry. Mary stopped. She tried not to laugh. That's right, a little softer, though. You don't have to strain your vocal cords, just a steady tone like mine. She sang it again, and the monster joined in, and it was not half as bad. She commended him, and they practiced until he could hold the note fairly steadily. Despite his guttural speech, he sang in a baritone more pleasant than she would have imagined. Good, said Mary. We'll call that note the melody. Now, I want you to sing it again. Here, I'll sing a little so you can imitate it. And then I'm going to sing a different note, an E, while you keep singing the C. Ready? Mary started in C, and when Adam had matched the note, she switched to E. The two notes, in totally different voices, created a chord that filled the night. As soon as he heard this sound, Adam stopped singing. He looked at her in astonishment. That's harmony, Mary said.
That was a fantastic reading, and this is a fantastic book. I would like to thank John Kessel, Nebula Award-winning author of Pride and Prometheus, for joining us today. John, it's been a pleasure.
Well, it's been fun to talk with you.
Once again, I'd like to thank John Kessel for joining us. Signed copies of Pride and Prometheus can be purchased in-store or online at www.quailridgebooks.com while supplies last. The North Carolina Book Festival is February 22nd through 24th in Raleigh, North Carolina, featuring local, national, and international award-winning and best-selling authors such as William T. Volman, Sandra Cisneros, Hadif Abdurraqib, Therese Ann Fowler, John Kessel, and Scott McClanahan. More information can be found at www.ncbookfestival.com. My name is Jason Jefferies, and this has been Bookin'.